Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust back in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Mike Zeidler, he runs something called Happy City, based here in Bristol. We'll be finding out how he intends to change the way we think about how we assess places. Is Bristol a happy city? And asbestos in the city, also in New York, on 9/11. We speak to a local asbestos consultant, Rick Margetts. And finally, Kevin Galeli. He's books Killing Us Softly, Peace Without Poison, and Survival Without Extinction are all about population control. He's had a very good look at what he thinks are attempts to reduce the global population by stealth. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. I'll give you contact details at the end of the show.
I'm Mike Zeidler, and I set up Happy City, oh gosh, in 2009-10, I think it was now, because for years and years and years I'd been in great rooms with wonderful people saying, yeah, we've got to make a change in the world, we've got to make things better. And you're always with people who agree with you saying the same things, and they're always saying, well, what about everybody else? So I got a bit, I got fed up with that. We're not making enough of a difference. And we set up Happy City to ask people what really matters. Let's find out what people say matters most in their lives and encourage people to understand the value of that. If we understand the value of it and measure it more effectively, then that's where money goes, you know.
And so is the idea to influence policy?
Everything. So I have a real problem with marketing people and the rest of it, because they say, tell us in a nutshell, what is it really, you know, you're changing. And we're saying everything, and it's for everybody. The idea is that we're told by the system at the moment that we have to uphold the economy, right? And the economy means money and stuff. It means get more money in circulation and buy more stuff. And if you really take an objective step back look at what we're told to do in any kind of crisis, it's basically go shopping. That's all. That's the only answer there is. It's not just unsatisfactory. It's incredibly
almost
damaging.
I go to Cabot Circus sometimes, yeah. And I think it's almost like a religion. It's almost a giant church, and everyone's turning up, and they get a little buzz out of spending. They smile, and it's a sort of affirmation that their life is great, everything's fine. The only trouble is, of course, if you go just a little distance from Cabot Circus, sometimes there's people sleeping in doorways. They're sleeping in car park. Staircases, you know, it's sanitised. It's what I'm trying to say.
Yes, I mean, and shopping malls have been, you know, compared to cathedrals before now by people. You're right. So, I mean, I think one of the things that sort of inspires all of this kind of thinking, I guess, is Bobby Kennedy's speech in 1968. I think it was in March 1968, so it's coming up to 50 years now, when he said a brilliant speech to a bunch of students graduating in Arkansas University, that GDP measures everything, in fact, except that which makes life worthwhile. That was his final kind of parting shot of this section of the speech. And that's the point. If we, you know, if you look at Red Nose Day, Sports Relief, or any of those days, you can see how much we value people who care for things, caring, you know, and looking after health, looking after the health of the environment.
Well, the reactions, for example, to the Las Vegas attack, to Grenfell Tower, is incredible. An outpouring of donations.
Exactly. And these are things that matter. So the point that what we're told is that these are costs, these are burdens on society, and we have to grow the economy, and then we can think about these other things. And that's so topsy-turvy, you know, that's nuts. You know, surely if we say these are the things that matter most and we value them, then they become the thing of most value. And in fact, an economy, from my point of view, should churn out buckets and buckets of prosperity, which means healthy people living on a healthy planet, you know, together.
So how do we do it?
So, It's in one way, it's very, very simple. Just ask that question, keep asking that question, and things will shift, because you can't really justify the current behaviour patterns. On the other hand, you know, we're just a little bit of nature. The only real governing rules are nature's, I guess. In fact, we even contain nature, don't we? There's loads of bugs and bits and pieces that aren't, strictly speaking, human inside us. So we kind of think of ourselves as individuals, but we're really not. We're very, very, very connected with everything that is living on this earth.
I mean, in the background to all of this, we've got something called austerity, and we've got a big change. We had a nanny state for decades after the Second World War. That's actually insult, but to call it a nanny state, but actually it was doing something very important. It was, for example, looking after the elderly, looking after the mentally ill, and making sure that people who, for whatever reason, didn't have work at least had the minimum to survive.
Exactly.
And that's all going.
And if you ask people the question, what matters, they will say, you know, these things about belonging, purpose, place. But basically, there are universals. And so you ask, how do we change it? So I've been sort of rambling around about, life, the universe and everything. And it all sounds a bit kind of muddled and pie in the sky. Actually, it's really, really, really simple. Ask a really powerful question. Keep asking the question. And then justify what's going on. So the other day, I was in a room full of people who are all fired up about social enterprise, so purpose-led businesses, organizations that are trying to do good in the world. So it's not just about the money, it's about what difference can we make. And collectively, they were kind of accepting that the money, they can do a certain amount, but they have to prove the value that they add in order to qualify for the money and the funding to make it all work. And I'm sitting there thinking, no, you need to challenge the banking system. You need to say to the casino bankers, hang on a minute, you tell us what value you're adding. How do you make a difference to what matters? Where's the prosperity you're actually delivering? Because I think it's a false promise.
Well, I think you're right. And I think also by looking at some of the articles written by bankers or people who are ex-bankers, they will say that there are two stories. There's one story that you tell to the public, and the other story is you're trying to make as much money as possible, and that you will get your bonuses based on how much money you make. And the bottom line is cash. There isn't really any morality, even though it's dressed up like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, and it's enshrined in corporate law. So companies have an obligation to make profit, and profit is defined as a financial return.
So does Happy City have to make a profit?
We're a charity and we're a CIC. So CIC is a community interest company, which means that we've got to serve a community with returns that do them good. And the charity obviously is governed by the Charity Commission. So no, we're not
okay,
for profit.
So here's the bottom line. From your point of view, is have you seen tangible results from what you've been doing?
Yes, definitely. In the last how many years? I mean, so we called it Happy City because happiness is the conversation about what matters. You don't say, I want well-being for my kids. You don't say, what you say is, you want them to be happy. What does that mean? And then people start explaining. So happiness, longest conversation in history, through all of our written records. It really says, why are we here on this earth and what are we here for? That's why happiness. Cities, well, that's the scale at which I think we can make a real difference. So we have to feel that what I do, what each of us does is connected in some way to communities, and those communities are connected through cities. And when we start seeing that scale, I know a city, I know where I am, I know that it feels like within my power to make a change. If people know that other people in cities are doing the similar sort of thing, then we are connected to that.
Now, have you ever lived in London?
Yeah.
Because it feels a little bit distant in London, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. And I mean, I think those sort of mega cities are a different kind of thing. Yeah, they're kind of cities within cities.
Once, that was one of the reasons I got out, is because you just couldn't come to grips with the place that it was too distant. And there was this whole area, the city of London, which seemed to be at the heart of everything, and yet all weekend it was abandoned.
It's empty.
It's a very bizarre thing to have at the heart of a city, is something which at the weekend, which was our big leisure time, you could walk through it and you could hear a pin drop, nothing going on at all.
And I know exactly what you mean. It's because there isn't any real community there. It's there for a particular purpose, and that's to
used to see people going into work in the city in the mornings, and when I get on the train going commuting back and join up with another train which is coming from Cannon Street, which is the city of London, it looked as if they'd spent the day having the blood drained out of them.
It was
horrible. It just
hideous,
didn't really seem to be an innovating job, so I never went for any jobs in the city personally. But anyway, tangible results.
So tangible results, I mean, I think, when I first went and spoke to the go-to guy in 2009 was Nick Marks. He worked at the New Economics Foundation, and I said to him, we want to up this thing, we're going to do happiness. He said, don't call it happiness. You can't touch the word happiness. No policymaker will take you seriously. And you look at where we are now. A few years ago, David Cameron rather stupidly kind of saying, this is where it starts. We'll have a big society. I mean, actually, that was a very misplaced comment. But happiness is now very, very much on the agenda from the UN and all the way through the system. In a way, I'd love to see a sort of G20 meeting where instead of having, or G22 kind of thing, you'd have the G20 meeting over here saying, yeah, these are the important people who are doing what matters. But you could also gather the people leading countries which are doing well on the Happy Planet Index. So Bhutan's been doing this since the 70s. But
yeah, I remember them having, I'm not sure, isn't it a monarchy?
Yes, that's right.
And they've got this thing called gross domestic happiness. So they're not so interested in how much turnover the country's getting through every year, which really means how much they can tax. It's looking at, how on earth do you measure something like that?
Well, this is where we're making great, great strides, you see, because... this is what Happy City does. I should have said this right at the beginning. What does Happy City do? We measure the well-being outputs of stuff, if you like. So if you can put that at the heart of the economy, then you'll have an economy that produces well-being.
You're fighting a losing battle against the stream, aren't you? If the government's taking away the support from the poorest, I mean, it's surely you're against the flow. You're going against the flow.
We're absolutely against the flow, but I wouldn't say we're fighting a losing battle. I think it's on the contrary. I think, you know, what happens is the more crisis you get, and the crisis has been building up, the more the demand is for saying, you know, basically the emperor's got no clothes. We need to change some stuff. You know, don't forget this model we're living with isn't very old at all. You know, it's really only post-Second World War that's gone in this direction as strongly as it has.
And also worth saying that since 2008, we've had the bailouts in 2008, multi-hundreds of billions of pounds, and the economy isn't really recovering. It's sort of on life support. So
exactly. This is exactly the point, is the economy is described as being this little thing which is just about finance. It's not. The economy, you go back to its Greek roots, is about who we are. You know, how are we? How is the house being managed? It's about having healthy people on a healthy planet.
So anyway, really, how can people come across and find you here in Bristol?
Yeah, I'm sorry, it's late in the day and I've had a really a real ramble, but we are in Victoria Street, where the web address is www.happycity.org.uk. We produce two measures. One is an index, which says, how are the conditions of a place? Are they good for promoting flourishing lives? And in January, I think probably we'll be releasing information about every single local authority in England, saying, here's how they are. And instead of just ranking them and saying, this one's 1, 2, or 3, which you can't do anything, what's the good of a number? They come with a scorecard, which helps people figure out, well, what can we do differently or better that will address
So what do you know already?
Social.
I don't want you to preempt what you're going to be saying next year, but what do we know about Bristol? How do we get on here?
We did well in 2016. We released some figures of the index in the first pilot phase, and Bristol actually did very well on 3 or 4 of the counts against sort of Sheffield, London. I can't remember the other ones. I haven't actually got the piece of paper with me that will remind me of the facts, but we did surprisingly well. I thought inevitably on the environmental side, I guess we've just been European Green Capital. There's a lot of sustainability interest here and environmental work, so we did very, very well on that. Inequality, of course, is an issue in Bristol. You know, we have got quite a big divide between the haves and have-nots, as is true more or less everywhere, but that's part of the existing system that we've just been describing. That's why that happens. So... yes, I'm sorry, I haven't bought the information.
That's right, fine. I just think, you know, how are we one of the better cities in Britain, and how do we compare to the rest of Europe?
Well, the conditions here, we've got everything we need to do really, really well, and Bristol does do quite well, partly because of the existing rewards you get from the existing system on, you know, so we've got things like aerospace and defence contracts and things like that, and finance, which aren't actually particularly good things, but they bring a lot of money. Which ideally we'd shift around so that the money flows because of the other things that we do really well, which is social enterprise.
And what about the mayor, Marvin Rees? Is he listening to this? Do you think he's tuned into this?
Totally. I mean, well, of course, he was working in public health before, and, you know, mental health is a significant part of our well-being, and it's a vital part of our well-being. I would argue that we have a mental ill health in an unhealthy economic system. It's mentally unwell, our economic system. He's absolutely buying into this, you know, definitely. Of course, his powers are
on the one hand, they seem great. On the other hand, they're quite limited, moving big systems. And when you're playing with politicians and politics,
well, he's got to turn a tanker around, doesn't he? Really?
Yeah, there's a lot to do. But I'm a big believer in tipping points. So stuff happens often, really quite suddenly and dramatically when people don't expect it. So I think what we're trying to do is apply pressure on the right kind of points that will help that shift to go. And of course, it's not just us. There's lots of people working on this kind of thing.
Okay, well, Mike Zeidler, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect. Maybe you could just finally remind us of where we can find you on the internet and physically in the flesh.
Thank you. Yes, we are on Victoria Street in Bristol, number 38 there. Our website is www.happycity.org.uk.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Right, well, I'm joined now by Rick Margetts. He lives here in Bristol, up in St George, around that area anyway, and he's an asbestos consultant. Rick, can you tell us what is an asbestos consultant?
Asbestos is... I tend to go around and advise companies on asbestos that they have in their buildings. Generally, you tend to find asbestos in buildings quite heavy in construction use between the 50s and 60s. We had a voluntary ban here throughout the 70s, and we finally legislated against it in 1985, but we still carried on using it until 1999.
Whereabouts were people likely to find it in buildings, old buildings?
You will find it... heavily around anything for fire protection. So particularly, we used to like putting on the underside of stairs, so you've got time to get out of the building when the building's on fire. You're less likely to get caught up with timber stairs catching fire. You'll find it in ceiling panels, and you'll find it within steel girders, which they used to put on for fire protection.
It used to be used for, I seem to remember, for roofing as well, corrugated asbestos roofing. I mean, this is going back a bit, probably 1960s.
Well, you get several different types of asbestos.
Oh, right,
you get your brown, your blue, and your white asbestos. Your brown and blue asbestos, more to do with sort of fire protection, and your white asbestos is more resilient to water. So you'll find it in rainwater goods, guttering, and that sort of thing.
So is any one more dangerous than another?
The worst type of asbestos you can get really is chrysidolite. Chrysidolite is your main two ones, really, are amosite and chrysidolite, which are normally a licensable type of asbestos. Your white asbestos, in most forms, it tends to be a non-licensed form of asbestos. It's a serpentine asbestos. It's not an amphibole like the other two.
So you better explain what that means. And tell us where asbestos comes from.
It's mined. It's a mineral. So it's mined out of the ground and then it's put into products. They have different properties for different sorts of reasons. A serpentine asbestos is more of a curly asbestos, a little bit more difficult for it to get into the lungs, which is why it's generally a non-licensed product. However, if it's in the form of pipe insulation or certain mill boards, it can still come under the licensed category. It's still listed as a carcinogen by the World Health Organization. And as I say, it was still used up until 1999.
Okay, so what are the general hazards?
The general hazards, when you breathe asbestos, you run the risk of the asbestos actually piercing through the membrane of your lung and lodging itself deep within your lung.
So these are little tiny little fibres?
These are very, very tiny little fibres. And so your amphiboles, your brown and your blue asbestos, they're almost like little javelin sticks and they'll get through. So your white asbestos, very difficult to get through. The problem with the buildings in the 50s and 60s, they're mostly full of licensed asbestos, particularly high-rises, commercial buildings. The rate of buildings that I find asbestos in within the country, it's very unusual that I don't find asbestos if I go looking. You may get one or two buildings out of 20.
So what's the law then? I mean, if you're in a building that may have asbestos in it, are you supposed to be checking to see if it has got it and getting rid of it?
You have a duty to manage under the asbestos regulations. You have to check it if it's going to deteriorate every 3 months if it's on the back of a fire door, because your fire door might be used quite a lot, so it's opening, closing, so it's higher probability that it's going to get damaged.
But it's okay. Whereas if it's not kind of deteriorating and flaking,
it's fine.
It's all right.
Absolutely fine. If it's not disturbed, it's in good condition, then there's no hazard. The only hazard is really disturbing it.
So tell us about some of the cases here in Bristol that you've come across of, you know, large amounts of asbestos suddenly coming across them.
I used to be principal consultant with the NHS, so I've looked at a lot of the hospital buildings around here. Most of the ducts around here have it. There's been terrible incidents with stuff going over at the NHS and trying to get rid of it and trying to log it all, because it's such, you know, it was so widely used.
We're talking about somewhere like French Hay, but hang on, that was probably wartime that was built, yeah?
Yeah, there's a lot of the ducts were, so you can still have, you could have a Victorian building and still come across it in. It really depends if the building's been refurbished in
the
BRI
50s,
'60s.
And then the General Hospital maybe even.
Yep, I found it in all of those. It's public buildings, it's generally always there. You tend to find most of the government agencies are better equipped to manage it. They'll have an estates department and they'll be aware of their regulations. Really, the bigger problem comes with the construction companies that just come in and they don't look for it properly. It's a consistent problem.
One of the things we really come to talk about this time is about the World Trade Center, because the 9/11 attacks, the two main twin towers, the World Trade Center, had a lot of asbestos in them. What was the story there? Because I understand that there was an attempt before the 9/11 attacks to look at it and consult over removing it all, because there must have been quite a lot in those two enormous buildings.
Well, there's an estimated between 1.5 and 2 billion to remove what was in the World Trade Centres.
Hang on a minute. I don't know how much they're worth. I mean, the building's worth how much, and it's going
to
cost.
Well, it's a very expensive product to remove. To give you a level of understanding on, if you've got an amphibole, if you've got a wall here which has got an amphibole material in and it's a licensed form of asbestos, you'll need to sheet the area off. You'll have to put the whole area under negative pressure. Everybody will have to have a full suit on, full face mask, sometimes breathing apparatus, and that will have to be damped down, or you can't just go in there and take that down, because a mask will only protect you for so many parts per million. So even when you take it down in a very structured environment, you have to take it down very, very carefully. You look at the demolition, how much would it cost to demolish a building in general, not a great deal of money. As soon as you put the asbestos factor and you have to take down what's a 10-minute job to take the wall down, then, you know, you're turning a small job into
so effectively
that's five
you can't times the size. Demolish it until you've actually taken the asbestos out.
You would have to take, in this country, we have to do a demolition survey before you knock a building down. And that's a fully intrusive survey, and that means you look everywhere within the building.
Because, of course, the problem might be that you bring the building down by whatever, a giant wrecking ball or by explosives, and that asbestos is then in the atmosphere.
Well, the problem is not just with the taking of the building down and the asbestos that's in the atmosphere. It's what happens to the asbestos after that, and where does the asbestos go? Particularly with the World Trade Centres, a lot of the trucks, it wasn't sifted, it just went straight into the back of the trucks, and it just went straight into open-top trucks, and then it was carted about 40 miles to the Fresh Kills dump. And that's where it sits today. It's still there at the moment. So potentially, en route, if that's in an open back truck full of amphiboles, you've contaminated that entire area all the way down to the fresh dump.
Okay, the EPA, you want to talk about an EPA statement. What is the EPA? Who was in charge of it?
The Environmental Protection Agency issued a statement saying that the World Trade Center, you probably remember them standing there a couple of days later, say the World Trade Center area, Ground Zero, is safe. There's no contaminants within the air. So Kate Jenkins came out almost immediately after, said there's no way the air is safe, and she lost her job. And she got sacked over it, and she finally got reinstated, and she won a court case and got her job back. She was reinstated back in 2012.
Right, because, I mean, this dust, after the collapse of the buildings, was everywhere.
Absolutely everywhere, yeah. We all seen the buildings come down. Now, that would have contaminated every single building within that vicinity. So to do an environmental clean, which would be your normal practice, so if you contaminate a wall just here and you knock this down and you've got dust over the floor, you shut this area down, and then it is environmentally clean. Potentially, the whole of New York really needed
a proper scrub,
an environmental clean. Which, except, you know, it's a big ask.
But do we know how many people were contaminated?
Well, currently at the moment, there's 400,000 people they suspect are on the watch list for asbestos.
So that is literally that they breathed in bits of asbestos fibres that were in the atmosphere in New York that day.
400,000 people that have breathed it in. I got the figures just there. There's 16,000 people on the fire department for New York list. NYPD responders, 34,000. Other city workers, 7,000. Other workers and volunteers, 64,000. I'm reading different figures from the ones that I'm just giving you. And you've got residents, businesses and schools. And schools are the worst that you can possibly contaminate, because you've got the kids and the kids are going to grow up with this. And it can take sort of 20 to 30 years to see the health effects of asbestos before it actually kicks in. And then you contract something like mesothelioma or asbestosis. So potentially you've got all these figures. And The World Trade Center Health Panel has come up with these figures, which I'll leave you. We're coming up there with over half a million. That's over half a million people, right there.
Have actually breathed this stuff in. Wasn't there some sort of duty? Yep. Since the people that owned the World Trade Center, the New York Port Authority, knew there was asbestos in the building, wasn't there some kind of duty on them to say, well, hey, guys, just put a mask on or something?
Absolutely. They said the opposite. Absolutely. Well, we all saw the images of the fire department in there clearing it, and you had all the volunteers coming up and all the rest of it. The EPA, to come out and put a public statement like that, is probably the biggest scandal. Particularly
Have they reined back on what they said? Have they apologised? Have they agreed to pay compensation to anyone that gets sick because of what they said?
They have agreed a compensation scheme, and they've put some figures together. I can tell you what those figures, and they're $392 billion as a total projected annual cost.
Good God. I mean, this is a sort of hidden scandal of 9/11, isn't it? I mean, imagine the government says it's okay to come out and, you know, you can breathe the air, but actually it's full of these little asbestos fibres.
I found a chap, I don't have his name right at the moment, and I looked this guy up, and this is from 1998, so this is just before the World Trade Center comes down. And he was facing he undertook a construction project. He buried a little bit of asbestos where he was, and then he took some asbestos and he fly tipped it somewhere. This guy was looking at a $250,000 fine and 5 years in prison for asbestos violations. And that's in 1998.
It's funny you mentioned that, because we've just had a scandal here in Bristol. As drastic, but along similar lines. That is with the company, the Cherngold company, who have been taking asbestos as toxic waste and then effectively, well, not quite fly-tipping it, but they haven't been doing the right thing with it. Anyway, what can you say about them?
I don't know masses about the particulars of the case on that one. I'll have a look at it and I'll give you a report on that and what I think a little further down the line. It sounds to me, from what I did see about the case, it sounded to be incompetence. I think that was what the judge came out and said.
He said incompetence, didn't he? But one does wonder whether it was, because these people are in a position where they're dealing with asbestos. There is really a duty on them to get to grips with what everyone knows asbestos is a very dangerous substance. They're being paid well over the odds to deal with this material because of its hazardous waste. They're in the waste industry. You would think that there was a kind of duty on people who were taking that extra dosh for dealing with asbestos to know what the law was. I think they
came out and said guilty. I think they pleaded guilty straight away, didn't they? So I think they've accepted that duty. But yeah, I mean, we've got duty of care. We've got asbestos regulations. We've got a whole army of safety regulations.
But they've been given suspended sentences, which effectively is a slap on the wrist saying, don't do it again. And these are 5 years after raids during the Environment Agency's biggest hazardous waste investigation, in which 10 people were arrested. Two directors have been given suspended prison sentences now at the conclusion of the case. John Bartram and Lee Phelan, both working for Cherngold, were sentenced on the 3rd of October this year on four charges following a hearing in Bristol Crown Court in July. Now, this case has dragged out a long, long time. The company Cherngold Recycling has been fined about £22,500 for these four offences. Now, a lot of effort's gone into uncovering that what they've done was criminal, but they're just given suspended sentences.
In most cases,
what I'm saying is the company's been fined, the individual directors haven't.
Well, that's generally a scandal anyway, isn't it, really, to be honest? Directors do seem to get away with that sort of stuff a little bit anyway. But it'll come down to where was it contaminated? Was anybody put at risk?
Well, they started, you know, back in 2012, the company put out a statement saying, "We regard the action taken by the Environment Agency as astonishing." Effectively, what they're doing is they're saying, we just don't recognise what they've been doing here. But, I mean, you're dealing with asbestos quite a lot. They should have known what they were doing.
You would think so, yeah.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Kevin Galilee, and I'm the person who uncovered the program of population control, exposed it in all its details, and have lobbied governments and organizations as well as the UN system to change the program from covert to overt methods of population control. In other words, to abandon the biological and chemical methods of mass poisoning and to adapt legislative means instead.
Well, hang on a minute, because poisoning, that sounds a bit extreme. In what way are we being poisoned? That worries me to hear that, if it's true.
Yes, it is indeed true, and it is now a proven fact, because all we need to do is look at ECHA's list of substances of very high concern, ECHA being the European Chemicals Agency, partly due to my work and the work of other activists and scientists as well. They have identified over 300 endocrine disruptors, which is the code word for depopulation poisons, that are present in our food system, in our beverages, in our consumer and cosmetic products.
Now, explain what an endocrine disruptor does?
It aims at subverting fertility and immunity, because that is how you control population growth. You control it at both ends of life by limiting births and managing deaths. In order to limit births, you have to subvert the reproductive system, and they do this through these endocrine disruptors. And as well, in order to manage deaths, you have to subvert the immune system. And in the last phase of the demographic transition, or the depopulation program, governments need to subvert immunity, because they have lopsided population pyramids. They have too many old people having subverted fertility for decades, and the population structures are unsustainable.
Now, how do you find out if you're buying a product if it's got an endocrine disruptor in the ingredients? Is there anywhere that it talks about products that might actually have that effect?
Yes, and you have to mind not only what is in the product. So you don't not only do you have to look at the label to read the label. And you quite easily can identify these endocrine disruptors, because all you have to do is compare the items list with ECHA's list of substances of very high concern. But you also have to mind the packaging material, because many of these endocrine disruptors leach into the food from the packaging. So, for instance, all foods packaged in plastic are contaminated with bisphenols, which is a very nasty endocrine disruptor.
So tell us about your book.
Well, I have written 10 on this subject, and they cover every aspect of the depopulation program. Some of them deal with the history, such as Killing Us Softly. Then I have a book that deals with scientific evidence, such as Peace Without Poison. And the others cover virtually every aspect of the depopulation and globalization program, because this is a dual program, the international system revolves around this axis of covert depopulation and coerced globalization.
Okay,
these are the grand objectives.
What's the motive? Other than obviously to reduce the population, why? Why do we need to do that? Surely there is actually enough food to go around, enough resources to go around for everybody on Earth.
The population in a natural state would double every 20 to 30 years. We cannot survive the next doubling from 7 billion to 14 billion, which would happen in 20 to 30 years. And had they not started to subvert fertility in 1945, we would already be a collapsed civilization. We would have long exceeded 10 billion, which is considered to be the absolute maximum number of people the Earth can feed, and not even sustainably. So we may be able to feed 10 billion people for a number of years or decades, but not sustainably. We would do it at the cost of all planetary boundaries. We would destroy nature.
Okay, so you've talked about the poison in our foods, which is rather worrying. At least we can check this out, you know, against a list of various chemicals. But what are the other methods?
Some of the other methods are vaccines, for instance, which nowadays constitute the new front of the depopulation genocide. Why? Having identified these endocrine disruptors as depopulation poisons, we have forced governments to begin the process of taking them out of the system. So they are reforming the chemical environment, but they're attempting now to substitute these covert chemical methods of depopulation with mandatory vaccination programs. So in other words, with biological methods of depopulation, which is why vaccines are being mandated right, left, and center.
Well, I know in the United States, there's something like 55 vaccines supposed to be injected into every child before the age of 5. I don't think most other countries are quite as excessive, but that does seem like a lot.
Yes, in fact, the United States has 75 vaccines. Canada is almost there well.
Last time I looked was a few years ago. I mean, so vaccines, we've got poisons in our food and poisons leaching into our food from the packaging. What else?
We have GMOs, for instance, which have built-in mechanisms of undermining our fertility and immunity. So in other words, scientists have designed these GMOs to produce enzymes that are destructive either to our reproductive system or to the immune system. And this is, again, a method that is used throughout the world. It is particularly relevant for the developing world because countries in the developing world cannot pay for this program. This program of controlling population growth is extremely expensive, and Western nations, the wealthy nations, no longer want to foot the bill. Then we have a series of psychosocial and economic methods of controlling population growth. For instance, delaying entry into the workforce, extending the education process and demanding all kinds of unnecessary credentials, forcing women into the workforce, which is now a method that the United Nations is attempting to apply throughout the developing world. Because once you push women to the workforce, what happens is that they do not have time for childbearing.
Well, hang on, because women are being given the choice of maybe applying for jobs and getting jobs and equal pay and this sort of thing. They're not actually being forced, are they?
Well, it depends how you look at it. There's certainly concerted effort to shatter, if you want, the social arrangements of countries in the developing world. This has already been done in the developed world. Women in the workforce is nothing new here. But for the developing world, this is a social shift of unprecedented proportions. And of course, it comes at a very bad time because jobs are already few and far between due to robotization and mechanization and digitization. So forcing now bringing 2 billion, 3 billion women into the workforce at this time, further suppress wages and would further put pressures on family incomes, forcing therefore both men and women to work in order to sustain a family, which was not the case before. And these are intended strategies for controlling population growth. If you force women to compete for jobs and to spend their time satisfying the job market, obviously they have very little time or no time at all for childbearing.
So any other methods? I mean, they're starting to mount up. We've got quite a few now, five or so.
Yes, we do. Wi-Fi radiation is also considered to be a dangerous new potential method of population control, although the evidence is scarce. Then there are a series of new technologies that are being tried now. One second, I'm just trying to find my notes here. Yes, for instance, every new scientific discovery, it is being potentially used for abuse by the depopulation lobby. You have, for instance, now food fortification, which is being used in the developing world. Then you have the adulteration of medical treatments, for instance, for malaria with artemisinin, which is a known sterilizant. So they use any kind of disease as a front for subverting fertility or immunity or both. So in other words, medicine and public health have been turned into handmaidens of genocide because governments need a pretext to get into our bloodstreams, to get into our bodies, in order to deliver these poisons, either directly or indirectly through the basic elements of life, or directly through vaccines, for instance. These are basically the methods that are currently in use.
Okay, so, but people probably, I mean, I won't be the first one to say this, I'm sure. Surely mm-hmm. some people think that you're just paranoid.
Yes, well, people who do not have the facts may very well think that, and indeed this program has such frightening proportions because it is global and such ambitious objectives because it has all of us at the receiving end. That one can very well be frightened. One should be frightened because none of us escapes this program. We're all at the receiving end, and unless we understand it, we cannot change it. So, in China, for instance, is proceeding the proper way, the legal way, by legislating limits to the family, and this is what will have to happen in the West as well. Here, however, a variety of structural obstacles stood in the place of legislation. But now that we see the damage done to our health and to our genetic and intellectual endowment being worse and worse from every generation subjected to these covert chemical and biological methods of depopulation, now is the time to force this program to come out into the open and to legislate limits to the family size. This would have to happen sooner or later anyhow, because the planet simply cannot support a doubling of the human population in perpetuity. As I said, we cannot survive the next doubling from 7 billion to 14 billion, and that is indeed something to be very, very frightened about, because if society collapses, if human civilization collapses, then we take down the entire Earth with us, and none of us will survive into the future.
But there's also a lot of people that say that the problem is not with overpopulation. It's just that the resources are just being controlled by a tiny elite who are just simply not sharing the Earth's resources around the food around the world.
No, that is not the case. The population doubling every 20 to 30 years, society is always attempting to stay ahead of the population growth to satisfy the food demand and the building of infrastructure. This has been an ongoing struggle. And now that we have reached the limits of the planet and we have no new continents to discover, it was high time in 1945 to begin this program. This is when this program of population control as an international system began, when the United Nations was formed.
Okay, so can you just remind us about your books, what the titles are and where people can get hold of them?
They can be purchased through Amazon, for instance. So you can go to your local bookstore and ask them, ask for them, or purchase them directly from Amazon. The most important ones, I would think, are Killing Us Softly, Peace Without Poison, Survival or Extinction. These three, I would say, are absolute must-read for everybody in order to understand this program, because we are all at the receiving end. So none of us can survive into the future unless we take proactive measures now. If they shut down our reproductive system, we will have no children. Already, that is the predicament of a quarter of the population of the Western world. And with the new generation, for instance, in some countries such as Japan, which was among the first to be subjected to this program, already 40 to 50% of the population is not only incapable of reproduction, it is asexual.
Finally, Kevin, why should we believe you? What are your credentials?
Well, my credentials are that the facts that I have assembled speak for themselves. I have dealt with this for the past 8 years. I am the only recognized expert in this field outside of the system. Those who are within the system obviously do not whisper a word about it, and for obvious reasons.
And is there going to be any success, do you think, with actually lobbying to make this an overt rather than a covert program?
Yes, it is inevitable. That is inevitable, and we will have a global replacement level fertility law within 5 years, is my guess, at most 10 years.
Okay, Kevin Galeli, I hope I pronounced that right. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
That's all for this week, Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. And subscribe and listen the week before broadcast, if you like, at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Mike Zeidler from Happy City, Rick Margetts talking about asbestos in Bristol and New York on 9/11, and Kevin Galeli, you just heard there. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the national volunteering website do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
This is Radio Freedom. KLF is gonna rock you. Kick this.
KLF is gonna rock you. we're now.